Grief can be the garden of compassion. If you keep your heart open through everything, your pain can become your greatest ally in your life's search for love and wisdom. This powerful quote from Rumi, the Persian poet and Sufi master born 807 years ago. He's been selling millions of copies of his poems in recent years, ironically making him the most popular poet in the US. Pain can be a real part of our lives. I'm guessing you've had some before. It seems to be a normal part of life for most of us at varying degrees, but does it really have to be? Is there a way to avoid it and live with more ease and grace and less pain in our overall experience, both in our emotional and physical body? As Eckhart Tolle, the Power of Now author, calls it, our pain body. I question some of my transformational leader friends often. I ask them this, do we really need to go to the pit of despair and deep, dark pain to get the lesson? To go all the way to the end of our rope in consciousness and physical capabilities to actually hear? Remember when Gay Hendricks shares in episode 2 about hitting an upper limit? These can show up in 3 ways he's found. The first, a relationship squabble. The second, a financial challenge. And the third, a physical injury. We will only allow so much good feeling in our lives before we hit our limit and create some way to not feel as good. We simply do it all the time. When we are confronted by something that could cause us pain, either physical or emotional, we can go into fight, flight, or freeze.
Have you run away from a saber-toothed tiger recently? Maybe you haven't, but the stress response you feel when you are late to work or the growl your stomach makes when you haven't had anything but an energy bar and coffee in the morning is the same stress response we had when we were cavemen. That stress response is called fight or flight. Grunk is a real-life caveman. He goes to work hunting saber-tooths and rabbits for his family. Unfortunately, the saber-tooth chases Grunk on occasion, and his physical and emotional stress levels go way up. When this happens, Grunk's body's intelligence kicks in to help him escape. His heart rate goes way up, his blood pressure spikes, more adrenaline is produced, and the body moves the blood away from the digestive tract and into the muscles, as digesting food isn't a priority at that moment. Grunk eventually does escape and rests at home, and after 15 to 20 minutes, his body resets and begins to operate normally again. Now, your body doesn't know the difference between running from a saber-toothed tiger or rushing your kids to school. Your body's stress response is triggered in both situations, so your blood pressure, heart rate, and food digestion is the same as Grunk's when he's running away from a tiger. These types of situations could happen every day in our culture. The difference between you and the caveman is the caveman was able to relax in his cave soon after he finished stressing out. So for the whole day, the caveman would stress the duration of a hunt, which would last maybe an hour. You, on the other hand, have to deal with the stress of racing your kids to school, traffic, work, relationships, and everything else that life constantly throws at you. Plus, add in the constant chemical stress that comes from the unhealthy foods we eat, and it's like you are running from the saber tooth all day long.
This awesome clip from Learning Junction, and one of the main things to remember here is that there are no tigers to run from, but we have many things, like it says, in our lives that will trigger the exact same response in our bodies. It is simply designed to keep us alive. Bruce Cryer, today's amazing guest, has had to face his dragon of pain on several occasions in very big ways. He's had a harrowing series of health crises involving both cancer and life-threatening staph infections. The healing process reawakened in him the desire to sing and to share his inspiration with audiences and organizations around the world. Bruce is now 6 years cancer-free while enjoying mad dancing skills again after bilateral hip replacement. Both hips he's had replaced. That's a big deal. He was an actor, singer, and dancer in New York, performing more than 800 performances as the boy in the world's longest-running musical, The Fantastics. And as Bob Marley puts it, one good thing about music, when it hits you, you feel no pain. As Bruce will share more about the heart from the heart math perspective, there are actually 3 brains in our bodies, including our heart. Of course, our brain. And the second is our stomach. And the third is our heart. Now, I'm guessing you've had pain in your head and pain in your stomach and pain in your heart. The good thing is this, once we ask where it is coming from, we can help make it go away. There's a message in all pain. We just have to ask. The year 1997, Mammoth Motocross. Deep in the Sierra Nevada mountains between Northern and Southern California, 8,000 feet of elevation, dry air, no oxygen. I line up for the 250cc semi-professional race. 39 other bloodthirsty riders gunning for the win. The gate drops. I get a bad start and I'm about mid-pack. I get super fired up and let no time go by before I start making moves. I felt an urgency like never before in hundreds of races before this one. I was dead serious and charging aggressively through the pack and was passing people left and right, each turn bobbing and weaving, making passes. I turn very sharp to square up another few bikes in a turn and slide sideways. I stop. Then bam! I get plowed over by four dudes going wide open right into my leg and my side. I was sitting there, turned sideways in a blind turn, and there was nowhere for them to go. Now, it's a rare occasion that I cry from pain, but let me tell you, a motorcycle with a semi-pro aggressive rider plowing directly into my right knee at full speed hurt very bad. And I even had a $1,500 custom carbon fiber knee brace on, still massive pain. Off in the ambulance I go to the emergency room, this only my second motocross-related ambulance ride, believe it or not. I find out after an MRI, I have a torn MCL and PCL ligament in my right knee and a broken finger and many cuts and some bad bruises. I was a mess. My addiction for years, motocross, my focus, my commitment to success no matter what. And you can bet that my heart rate was through the roof when I was riding this amazing machine. Not only is motocross rated the number one most physically demanding sport on the planet, it's damn exciting and super tough on all parts of your body and mind, including your head, stomach, and heart. I've had like 6 concussions. My heart has been broken many times from following my passion and failing at some level. And I used to eat Advil and Vicodin like it was candy, destroying my stomach. It was still worth it, all of it. Now, I faced my fears on the motocross track. This passion then turned into standing on stage in front of hundreds on a regular basis, shaking in my shiny shoes and suit and tie, and equally the same amount of challenge and rush. I'm guessing you get this if you're a speaker or leader of sorts, the thrill of it all. You can bet that I had many, many moments of fight, flight, or freeze in facing my dragons on the track, crashing and burning. And as a producer of almost 200 live events with some of the biggest thought and business leaders on the planet, in my over 20 years of being an entrepreneur, I have taken some licks and been eaten by the tiger. Have you? As the late Mary Tyler Moore says, take chances, make mistakes. That's how you grow. Pain nourishes your courage. You have to fail in order to practice being brave. Welcome to the Face Your Dragon podcast, where we help you, a messenger with a mission, leverage your fear to amplify your voice in the world. On the show, we open up the concept that what you are most afraid of and most resisting are the very things that will set you free. With courage, with clarity, with contribution, you can have it all. This show will engage in deep, enriching conversation with thought leaders, best-selling authors, celebrities, athletes, icons, and regular Joes who have faced their fear and are now using it to create impact in the world. I'm Brad Axelrad, and I'll be your host. My dear soul brother Bruce has been called a Renaissance man because of his 4-decade career as a singer, actor, dancer, publisher, author, marketing executive, CEO, board member, consultant, mentor, and coach for leaders in diverse fields. In 1980, he joined a startup as VP of marketing that introduced spirulina to the world. I eat spirulina every day. It's amazing stuff. In 1990, he was asked to join the founding team of HeartMath. And in 2000, he was named president and CEO and successfully guided relationships with Stanford Business School, Mayo Clinic, Shell, NASA, Kaiser Permanente, UCSF Medical Center, Intel, Duke University, and dozens of high-performing organizations in the US, Europe, Asia, and Africa. Bruce blogs for The Huffington Post, Real Leaders, Mind Body Green, Project Happiness, and Collective Evolution. With his business partner, multi-Emmy award-winning composer Gary Malkin, I love Gary, he's amazing, he created a project called What Makes Your Heart Sing, which features a powerful keynote performance designed to bring the power of inspiration to audiences around the world. Listen in as this amazing soul shares some deep, heartfelt stuff. Bruce, it's so great to have you on the Face Your Dragon podcast again. I'm really honored to have you do a full episode today. Welcome.
Thank you, man. This is a treat for me. It's great to connect with you again, and I'm excited to see what unfolds today.
I laugh because I really never know where these are going to go and let spirit kind of surface whatever's supposed to be of service today. So coming from that place, is there anything that you've noticed in the world today that's kind of stressing people out? And have you seen like a rise in fight, flight, or freeze response in people overall? What have you noticed kind of just in the general climate with this new political climate or anything in particular?
Oh, not much at all, Brad. I don't know what you're referring to. Yeah, it's been really a wild ride, hasn't it, since about 11 p.m. Pacific, November 8th, and then jumping up again January 20th, et cetera, and the hits go on. It's been wild. Yeah, I think, you know, living in California, where we have a very large number of immigrants, Hispanic immigrants in particular, and many of whom are not here legally, and yet they are loved in their communities, they are needed in their by the people who employ them. And just tuning into the level of anxiety just in that population alone, fearing deportation, fearing breaking up of families. And that's millions of people just in this one state, many of them around in this area. You know, that one factor alone is sobering to realize the angst that millions of people are going through. And then multiply that by all the other variations of things going on in people's lives right now. It's an extremely challenging time. I think it's really a time to hold on in a certain way, both hold on and let go. Hold on, because it's a wild ride, but also let go of certain expectations of how things are used to be and that they will necessarily continue. It's a time of tremendous change and transition, and therefore a need for patience, for forbearance, for compassion. A lot of stuff going on now flying around, and we need to stabilize as best we can.
Yeah, and HeartMath, and I've certainly heard from you often speaking of a state of neutrality or coherence. Is there a way, I mean, there's obviously personal coherence, maybe there's even a collective sort of body of coherence. Can you speak to how that plays out?
Yeah. You know, I think all of us have had the experience of meeting someone or walking into a room and sensing something energetically happening in the room, even without people telling you, you know, there was just an argument or there was just something romantic or whatever. We pick up on stuff. And HeartMath, one of its contributions, and many people love this particular statistic that HeartMath didn't even come up with, but we helped to publicize, which is that the electrical signal of the heart is so powerful. It trumps every other signal, every electrical signal in our bodies by a significant factor, 60 times stronger electrically than the signal put out by our brains, for example. So that electrical power of the heart is the dominant one in the body by far, and the magnetic and the rhythmic. And one of the things that's been studied now by a number of institutions, and we came along, HeartMath, and looked at it as well, is that the electrical signal creates a field, just as every electrical substance, an electrical transformer creates a field around it. And if you drive under one, it causes static in the radio. Now I'm dating myself, aren't I? So anything electric, every living thing has an electrical field as well. Plants, trees, humans, animals. So we know that. That's all already been well established. In the case of the human heart, the signal is so powerful, you can easily pick it up anywhere on the body. You can't pick up brainwaves outside of the skull because the heart signal is so much more dominant and more powerful than the signal put out by the brain. And that signal of the heart does not see the skin as a barrier. In other words, the electrical signal goes out farther than just the edge of the skin, and it can be measured several feet away from the body. So basically, we are, one aspect of being human is that we are electrical, and the electrical signal produced by the heart creates a field. It's kind of a donut shape. It's called a torus shape, torus, T-O-R-U-S, and that field can be measured several feet away. Well, we are all sensitive beings. We're human. We're sensitive to each other. We're sensitive to energies, etc. We can often sense the mood of another person just being within a few feet of them, right? You feel someone in a very appreciative, caring mood. It feels nice to be around them. You feel somebody in a frustrated, angry mood, not so nice. So HeartMath came along and said, and that's measurable because this is part of what the body is actually producing electromagnetically.
That's really interesting. So one thing that comes to mind as you're saying that is the experience we have around others, the experience we project into other people's experience. But one thing that I've been in the exploration of is really around being an empath or an HSP or a highly sensitive person. And I'm wondering, have you guys ever done any studies around that or noticed any differences in some people, that some have a bigger field of energy around their body or their heart or their brain and some have less, or what's going on there?
That's a really great question. And I think one kind of caveat I would put out about all of this is that if there's anything that HeartMath learned, and certainly in my own personal experience over roughly 40 years now of of exploring various transformational methods in myself in terms of diet, exercise, meditation, spiritual practice, let alone the research HeartMath has done looking deep into this, especially from a heart-brain standpoint, is that there are no two signatures, no two humans that are the same. You know, we all have different capacities, different needs, different biological output. There are patterns that are similar amongst all of us. We all have hearts that produce electrical signals. Some of us, for reasons that aren't related to spiritual development at all, could have a stronger electrical signal than another person. If the signal is stronger, it's probably going to go out in space farther than a weaker signal. That doesn't mean they're more loving. That doesn't mean they're a better person. That just means they've got a stronger signal. And for reasons that are unique to their own physiology and their own genetic makeup. So yes, there's no question that both this kind of the size of the field, the intensity of the field, and even what's happening within the field does change person to person and moment to moment. So one of the things that was very powerful in HeartMath's early research in the early 90s was not only can this field be measured several feet away from the skin, away from our bodies, but what's passing through that field, the electrical energy coming out of the heart varies depending upon the emotional state that we're in. So it literally can be measured to look different whether when we're feeling appreciation or gratitude or love or compassion compared to when we're frustrated, sad, depressed, angry, etc. The field itself looks different and can be seen through scientific equipment differently. I don't mean it looks different from an aura standpoint, but is measured to have different waveforms. So that's profound. In other words, when we are feeling stressed out, the field itself is kind of chaotic, which is what it feels like when we're highly frustrated. On the other hand, when we're feeling appreciation or gratitude, the form that the heart pattern takes is called coherent. That's a word that HeartMath has used a lot, the idea of coherence. So the wave itself produced by the heart's electrical signal is smooth. It's called a sine wave. Whereas when we're feeling frustrated, it's more like an earthquake pattern, kind of chaotic, kind of all over the place. That one visual, sine wave, smooth, peaks and valleys in a beautiful smooth rhythm, which is associated with positive feelings, versus a chaotic kind of earthquake looking rhythm when our body, our heart, our emotions are experiencing more chaotic emotions, that's now well established. So it's quite profound that these things, which maybe in the past and for millennia were more spiritual concepts, now science is able to come along and say, and we can measure this using mainstream scientific methods, not just, you know, alternative methods.
It's really great. So science and spirituality coming together and physiology and biochemistry, it's so awesome, which is the conversation I love to be in. And I know you do too. And a lot of our friends are in that conversation. It's just so rich. A couple things came to mind. First of all, do you guys call the heart the second brain or third brain? Because our stomach is our third brain, is it not?
Well, it depends. It really doesn't matter, the sequence. I mean, because for hundreds of years, we believed there was only one brain. Therefore, the one in our skull is considered to be the first brain. And then there was a book actually written 15, 20 years ago about what's called the nervous system in the gut, the enteric brain, it's actually referred to, or the enteric nervous system. And some people call that the second brain. And some of those researchers weren't aware yet that there was another one in the heart. So some people refer to that as the third brain, but it's more just about the sequence of who's discovering what, not priority, orders of importance necessarily.
Interesting. Okay.
No question that the brain is the master controller. No question about that. But it's also a synthesizer. It's not just controlling. So it's gathering, it's aggregating data from all over the body, especially from the heart and the gut. The brain's in those two areas. And so the brain in our skull is processing information received from these other brains and from other sources from all over the body and making decisions on raise heart rate, slow heart rate, increase lung capacity, you know, stop digestion, whatever. The different things are happening at high speed based on what are the apparent needs based on our perceptions of our body. So the brain's still the one managing 90% of that through the autonomic nervous system, but it's getting a tremendous of intelligent input from the gut brain and from the heart brain and
right.
Many other systems as well. So it's a wildly fascinating, complex human system, and pretty wild when you think about how much intelligence really is happening within the body. Intelligence is by no means confined to the head. That's where a lot of it gets aggregated and plenty of it is accessed and produced. But there's intelligence kind of everywhere, really.
Right. Well, one thing I've really been exploring mainly in the last year or so is gut healing and how much of the ailments I've had throughout my life and how many of the ailments that family members, friends, people I see, and they're explaining or sharing some challenge they're having physiologically, physically. And I'm saying, wow, have you thought about gut healing? And the point is this, that there's so much emotion that can come from an like an unstable gut or just GI tract. And I mean, do you know much about that? Can you speak to that?
Well, actually, I've been very fortunate in that that's been sort of the least of my issues from a physiological standpoint. And as you know, my story, I've had plenty that I've had to deal with in other parts of the body than the stomach or gut. So it's not something I've had to firsthand go through all the processes of healing, et cetera. On the other hand, where I felt the most emotional tension my whole life was in the gut. I just was lucky that it didn't ever play out in anything. One time I got salmonella poisoning, which I would not wish on anybody. That was 2 weeks of gut hell.
Oh my gosh.
Trust me. And I was in South Africa when it occurred.
Wow. So
it wasn't exactly the ideal place to have it happen if you're going to get like really sick for a few weeks. But anyway, that's what happened. But for me, it's been more just being ever more sensitive to tension that I carry there. Tension about my worth. Tension about my well-being, tension about other people that I care about in my life, that I worry about. And whatever the collective, you know, the top 10 worries of the week might be, tend to collect themselves and like set up shop and have a good old camp going down there in the gut. And as somebody who has been aware of that ever since I was about 4 years old, of a certain anxiety, initially it was sort of related to separation anxiety with my mother, but then it carried on into other patterns that had nothing to do with my mother. And yet that it's been a very real thing that I've dealt with and something I've become ever more sensitive to as life has gone on, that anything that is kind of starting to collect there for whatever reason. And oftentimes we really don't know the reason and don't need to know the reason. What we need to do is clear it. And sometimes it's better not to name or label these things and just, okay, I got energy trapped there. I got to move this puppy or I'm going to be, my whole system is going to slow down and my perspective is going to weaken and my heart's going to kind of drain a little bit as well. So that's more the approach that I've taken. But again, because I've had a, so far, knock on wood, a lack of those kinds of problems other than the very real one of feeling a tension and sort of an angst more in my life over the years than I would want to. Uh-oh. And continue to work on it in ever deeper levels of just letting go and loving at deeper levels and letting go of expectation, letting go of things that are, you know, part of my social conditioning or related to aging or whatever the issue may be. And just to try to let go at deeper levels and replace that with love, more and more love, more and more love.
It's amazing, Bruce. So I the same thing for me. I have a hypersensitivity right in my solar plexus, right at the bottom of my rib cage there. And same process, let go, love it when it's there. Don't make it wrong. Don't get more scared around it. Like there's such a gift to be able to love our pain, to love our fear, to allow it to be, to ask it what it wants from us or what it's trying to share with us. There's great power in it. But you're right, the naming thing, sometimes that can be a little bit of an intellectual process instead of an emotional sort of body or sensory experience, right?
And coming back to what you brought up earlier about this energetic field of the heart, the electromagnetic field of the heart. So that's not just relevant for us. It's relevant for the fact that we are interpenetrating each other's fields all the time, unless we live on the mountaintop and never have any human contact. Even there, it's arguable that there's probably ways that the field at another, maybe at a quantum level, is communicating way farther than 8 or 10 feet away from the body like the electromagnetic field does. It could be much farther than that. At another level we haven't been able to learn how to measure yet. But I think the being able to be kind of centered in ourself and finding that coherence, that neutrality, is both a fundamental premise of heart math, but also to me just about life. I mean, there's so many things that are happening these days where it's kind of like the not even just the daily shock, almost the hourly shock of what's happened in the last hour in Washington or wherever. It's not just about the political situation in the U.S., in Brexit, in you name it. I mean, there's so much crazy stuff going on for many people. So it's to be able to remain neutral and not have every single one of those moments be yet another kind of stab in the gut. But at the same time, when you're feeling that, to not deny it or repress it at all either. So it's quite a balancing act we're in the middle of now. And I think that's why love and compassion for oneself, loving, as you're saying, loving the fear, accepting the fear, whatever's going on in there, not pushing it down, not denying it, but also letting it go where you realize it's now causing a block. I recognize it. It's okay. But now I will wish it on its way.
Yes. There comes a point where it's time to move it through, like you said, you know, just shake it off, move it through. So let's talk about that. You know, obviously as a speaker or coach or entrepreneur or even a mother of three, I mean, we all have fear. We're all dealing with some level of low-level sort of cultural anxiety or weather anxiety or employment anxiety or relational anxiety, fear. There's constant, like you said, stimulation, external stimulation or stimuli. What are some of the things that we can do as, you know, most of the folks listening to this are courageous souls wanting to take the leap somehow and break free from their current life or current pain or jump to Costa Rica like I did, something like that. So what are some of the things we can do to recognize when it's happening? You know, what's the sequence when a fear comes up?
Yeah, well, I think kind of like I was saying earlier with the design of humans being so uniquely customized to us, or as the Brits would say, bespoke. We're customized, personalized versions of what it's like to be a human. Having said that, you know, I think there's a number of things for me, and I think some things that are kind of generally true for everybody, even though we are so unique and have specific needs that nobody else really has. So part of that for me is learning to get into a flow with our own creation energy, our own creativity. And as you know, I do a lot of creative things, and for years I didn't. When my work life forced me to get more and more narrow focused as kind of an executive and managing things and teams and people and traveling a lot. But there was a part of my spirit which needed to be singing again and needed to be dancing, because I needed to be moving energy through and I needed to feel the joy of dance and needed to have time to do photography or write poems or write blogs or whatever it may be. So that creative energy that has been a part of me since I was a kid was not out as much and was feeling very restrained by me. Nobody was forcing me to do anything. So for me, getting into the creative flow again and just allowing myself to do things that I love to do creatively, not because of income needs or anything else, just for the pure joy of doing it, is absolutely essential. Because to me, when the more we're in touch with what makes our heart sing, a phrase you know that I have used with this my creative partner, Gary Malcolm.
I know well.
This project called What Makes Your Heart Sing, it's helping people get in touch with what are the things in life that can be taking care of your garden, that can be a puppy, a kitten. It can be having the sense that the difference you're making in the world is really impacting other people's lives. It can have a whole range of colors and variations and tastes and flavors. But being in touch with those things, not pushing them down in the name of the almighty dollar or the job or the steady income or whatever, but doing those things too are essential to helping the flow of energy in our system. So yeah, life is fun. I'm doing what I'm meant to do. I'm doing me. I'm not just doing the job for the outcome of enough money to maintain the lifestyle. I'm sort of out of that equation. But the creative spark is me fully operating. So I'm a big believer in what I call developing the Renaissance human in each of us, ability to have the rebirth of, yeah, man, when I was a kid, I used to draw and I used to just be playful. And what happened to that energy? Now I'm 40 and I kind of feel like 80, you know, or now I'm 60 and feeling like 120, you know, whatever. Where's that playful energy again? And a lot of times it can come from just doing things we love, things that don't have to be public, nobody else needs to know we're doing them, but we're just doing them for the sheer joy of, man, I freaking love this. And so that's a big one. Related to that, many people in their list is being in nature, right? Just got back from a 2-hour hike with my friend Gary, and we were walking on this ridge line here in Marin County in Northern California, just absolutely sparkling days, sunny, warm, spectacular views. And we're having a great conversation too. So two things happened this morning. One was our systems were kind of cleansing just being out in this beautiful, awesome nature. Secondly, we were having a deep conversation. So we were each getting clarity on stuff in our life that was kind of holding us back, or where we had anxiety or fear or whatever. So being in nature, the incredible rejuvenative, restorative power of nature, it's here for us. Most of us don't spend nearly as much time drinking in the power of it. And the second is the ability to share with people that whose opinions matter, whose instincts and whose wisdom we trust, so that we're able to, again, get clarity on what's happening inside ourselves. And other people often that know us well can see subtle things in us that we're not quite picking up yet, right? It's obvious to somebody else before it is to us many times. So all of these are aspects that to me matter in the name of getting past the fear. And so the fear isn't the default state.
Love it. So what actually happens physiologically, biochemically, you know, to our body when we get in a state of fear? What's the cascading of hormones and stuff? How's that work?
There was some research done in the early 90s, actually, that showed that a single very commonplace stress response that we all experience probably dozens, if not hundreds of times a day. You see the name of somebody in your email inbox or a text, and you have an instant kind of you kind of clench because, oh, it's him, or oh, it's her, you know, with that instant reaction. Or you're in traffic and somebody cuts you off and you have that startled reaction, right? Or it's just looking at the volume of emails that came in the last hour while you were trying to meditate. You know, whatever the issue is, we're going through lots of these reactions. 25 years ago or so, it was proved and published in a scientific journal, the idea that in any of those moments, a profound biochemical cascade starts to happen in our bodies. It's like we're the foreman of this factory of biochemicals that we're producing every moment we're alive. We're kind of unconscious to it, but we're still pushing the button. So if we're experiencing fear, a button gets pushed, biochemically speaking, I'm using a metaphor, obviously, by us, and a cascade begins. And back in the early 90s, they were able to identify 1,400 discrete biochemicals, two of the famous ones being cortisol, the stress hormone, adrenaline, the drug of choice by many people who are highly stressed or highly aggravating. 1,400 distinct biochemical changes start to occur, certain hormones getting released, biochemicals getting released, brain chemicals getting released into our bloodstream because we're perceiving fear. What's kind of scary about that is that whether or not the fear is real, that's what your body's going through. Your body's gearing up for a fight or a flight. And so if you then discover, you open up that email that caused the reaction and you discover, actually, on this particular day, Jim, the guy that I hate, was sending me a joke that I found kind of funny. Well, guess what? Of those 1,400 biochemicals, many of them have a half-life of like 10, 12, 13 hours. So even though the threat seems to have passed, the adrenaline is still in your body for many more hours. And so some of these biochemicals that surge when we're experiencing fear, threat, strong anxiety, et cetera, if we don't do something to clear them out or replace them with a positive experience, which is would be associated with gratitude or compassion or loving nature or any of those things, we're left with the biochemical consequences of that threat reaction. Those biochemicals don't just go poof when we realize there's no threat after all. That's sobering. And so what you realize is all those biochemicals, when we continually push them to our system through no fault of our own, it's just how our body's reacting, kind of we're not kind of unconscious to all this, that's implicit in why we age ahead of our time. That's implicit in why people who've been through an incredibly stressful 6 months based on family issues, health issues, etc., might look like they've aged for 3 years. Presidents in office look like they age way faster than the normal population as we, you know, in their 4 years or whatever. So these are all examples of kind of the biochemical consequences of having these stress reactions constantly in our bodies. And if we don't have an opposite, a surge of love, a surge of compassion, so that starts to feel more normal instead of the surges of fear and anxiety feeling like that's the normal. If we don't do something, we're living with those consequences. And a lot of people develop all kinds of chronic conditions. Their energy is not anywhere near what it could be. You know, we all know the drill. So I think the big insight now is that our ability to identify, experience, and learn how to shift these emotions in our favor has everything to do with our mental clarity, our cognitive function, our physical well-being, and our longevity. So it's a pretty tight package when you really, and it makes sense, you know.
It really does. It's so interesting. Like you said, the presidents, that was such a perfect example. I mean, man, they aged 10 years in those 4 years. Like you look at pictures of Obama his first year in and 4 years out, like, wow, he was so young. But exactly. Two things come to mind. First of all, I just remember, you know, growing up in a dramatic childhood, like most of us do, but I certainly had some, wasn't any physical trauma, but just lots of like yelling. My dad would just like lose his shit. He just didn't really have any emotional intelligence and he was just on or off, right? He would like stuff his feelings and then just explode because back then, you know, he would be, oh boy, I guess 82 now if he was still around. But the point is like, men in particular, I think that's kind of an MO back in the day, stuff, don't show any emotion. And then like anger was somewhat more acceptable. But the point is this, I feel like I've always had this theory that I pattern matched a lot of the chemicals or vibrational frequencies or neural pathways or whatever I had sort of stored. I mean, even in the fat cells and my muscle, like I would create scenarios that would physiologically and biochemically pattern match my wounding. Does that make sense that we'll recreate scenarios so that we get the chemicals that we're used to experiencing? Like you said, adrenaline. I mean, I was an ex-motocross racer, almost professional motocross racer for years. And I, in retrospect, 15 years after, I looked back and said, wow, I was simply pattern matching a lot of my unresolved trauma so that I could get the adrenaline. You know, you mentioned adrenaline.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is a fascinating conversation, really, because as the field of understanding the brain's role in all this, the neural circuitry of all this, the fact that anything we've ever learned to do, anything, speak a language, learn how to do a podcast, ride a bike, you name it, there's circuitry that is associated with that, which allows us to keep doing it. If we didn't have the circuitry to speak, we wouldn't be able to speak. If we didn't have the circuitry to do art or surf or do motocross, we couldn't keep doing it. So it's not just about memory in some cognitive way. It's about muscle memory and the circuitry that underpins all of that. So the circuitry is a really big deal. And I think it's easy to have, you know, you get hooked on a certain feeling associated with certain types of activities, like you talk about motocross or extreme sports or things like that. And that there's a certain, I don't know, not being a neuroscientist, I don't know if we create new circuitry to match the feeling we associated with that one. And that's kind of how it works. So if we love the thrill and the adrenaline of motocross, then we'll try more things to get good at that kind of repeat that same feeling, like snowboarding or whatever, or extreme anything, you know, skiing off of helicopters or whatever it may be. And I'm not exactly sure how that works from a brain standpoint, but it kind of makes sense, doesn't it, that some process you're hooked on, you love that. There's clearly circuitry involved. There's clearly biochemical releases that are associated with that activity, and you want to keep repeating that. And because it satisfies something that is giving you that juice, that edge, that stimulus that you're craving.
Yeah, well, there's something so much to say for that, you know, to come alive. As a friend of mine here in Costa Rica says that some things or challenges will make very masculine men come alive. And I agree with that completely. Like at the core of our being as men, there's this, I want to push death in the edge of existence, whatever that my existence, like the world's existence, like there's something in us that drives us. And it's an interesting thing. One thing I've noticed just is that there's a lot of opportunity if we're willing to lean into that edge, whatever that edge may be. It may not be extreme sports. It might be public speaking. Like I've said numerous times, that was one of my biggest dragons for years. Like I would get so overstimulated on stage, like, and it was partially just because I didn't really have a message, you know? I mean, now I've got a message I could speak to any audience about what we're talking about now. And there's a lot more resonance and a lot more resting in that place. But really, you know, what is it that we can, how can we challenge ourselves to open our heart more? You know, a lot of us will say open our hearts. Like, how can we live a more heart-filled life, a more love-filled life, Bruce? What gets in the way for people, and how do we do that?
Well, that's a deep question, Brad. That's awesome. Well, I think it's a great question, too, as a follow-on to the kind of more the adrenaline hook that we were kind of referring to earlier. And I think for many people, and again, I keep wanting to emphasize that we are all so different. And so that even though, yes, there is this male energy that wants to just, you know, that is true. In some men, that's really pronounced, and that's like a major driving energy. In other men, it's way more in the back seat, but it may play out differently. And so I think, like for me, yeah, that kind of, I would call it tribal energy, or, you know, just deep in the earth kind of energy, for me gets expressed the most powerfully in dance. That's where I experience that and really come to life in those kind of sensitivities. At the same time, I think part of the challenge for many men is having as much courage to explore non-stimulating, non-aggressive modalities. That could be way more challenging emotionally, because it's like getting in touch with what you really feel. And it's in relationship with this other species of human called a woman, whoever your partner is.
Yeah, right. That's probably one of the biggest dragons we all face, is understanding interpersonal dynamics. And you're right. Like I, for years, for decades, chased and faced my dragon by way of extreme sports and pushing the envelope there physically, because I was a young man full of testosterone. And then you're right. The even bigger, deeper, more scary work was looking inward.
And I think that's definitely true. And it is more scary in certain ways, because it's really unfamiliar territory. You can't just, you know, go for it and know you got the gear that's going to support you, or you got the athleticism that's going to pull you out of it. This is new territory. The rules of those games don't apply here. And yet, I think what a lot of us experience, whether it was extreme sports or whether it was, I mean, my case, as you know, I was an actor and singer and dancer, and that was an incredibly stimulating occupation to be in, and very addictive, because once you get that audience applauding for you and laughing at you, you know, you keep wanting that. And that's got its own, you know, addiction, of course, just like extreme sports would have. But I think for a lot of us, if we go through those periods, and then at some point it's kind of like, wow, that's just really not soul satisfying. It's fun. I like having a life that's doing stuff like that. It was cool doing the hike this morning on the ridge. At the same time, there's times where I just want to be quiet. I just want to cuddle. I want to have a soft time in life and feel like that's manly too. That's not about not being manly to be soft. Right. What good dad, what good father does not have a soft side that can relate to the baby and the toddler and the teenager with care and love, but also tenderness. And so I think that's a frontier for a lot of men, is to be willing to explore both feeling another person's tenderness, whether that is our partner or whether that is a child or anyone, just even a close friend.
Anyone, but also, at all, yeah.
Or also to our experience, our own, to notice after the applause dies down, or whether after the adrenaline starts to fade away and you recognize, wow, I just really wish I had a partner right now. I'm feeling lonely. And to accept that tender feeling in you that is wanting that, or, you know, whatever the particular feeling or situation may be. I'm speaking kind of personally because I've gone through that any number of times in my life.
Yeah, and, well, you bring up a good point. I'm sorry to interrupt, but Alison Armstrong, I was listening to her last week, and I was chatting about this with Ariel Ford just a couple days ago about, you know, in relationship, it can shift as we get older, that the chemicals start to change and men have less testosterone and they start wanting more of the feminine or womanly kind of things, right? Like you were saying, like, I get it, man. It's like, I just want to cuddle sometimes or need that sort of nurturing. So we've talked a lot about things that people can do to sort of create that space for themselves, hiking, cuddling, extreme sports, whatever it is that fills you up. Let's talk a little bit about addiction or distraction. I don't know if that's really going to be your milieu, but let's chat about that, Bruce, because that's a big one for a lot of folks on here, at least a conversation I like to be in. I call it chasing the dragon, right? We've all heard that term from the opium dens. And once you take your first hit of the opium, you'll be chasing the dragon forever. Never get that same high or that same buzz. And you'll continue to recreate or attempt to recreate scenarios to get that high again. So where does addiction and distraction come into play with HeartMath or these philosophies? Anything you can share there?
Another excellent question, Mr. Brad. Yeah, another very big topic. I was noticing something in myself recently that kind of interested me, and I kind of laughed about it. I mean, I sometimes go weeks where I'm not doing this, and occasionally I'll do it three times in a week. I go to a gym and work out. I do a lot of other exercise, hiking, dance, etc. But I love to go into the gym sometimes. And I do this thing where I never have my phone with me in the gym. And, you know, most of the people in there are listening to music on headphones and then, of course, frequently texting. And they're, you know, sitting there on a machine, on a weight machine or a leg machine or whatever they are. And they're texting and they're whatever they're doing. And I thought, you know, there's no way I would do that. Like, I want to just really focus on the exercise while I'm there. And I don't want to be, I know I'll be distracted. I know it's going to pull me in because that happens so much. I just want to get the full experience out of the exercise and all the benefit I can get from the exercise. But what was funny to me was that where I'm very disciplined when it comes to exercise, I'll have my phone with me when I'm meditating. And sometimes I'll kind of check while I'm meditating.
I do too. I totally do that.
And so it's like I kind of punked myself the other day and said, dude, you know, seriously, you keep your phone out of the workout room, but not out of the meditation room. That's really freaking upside down. So it was kind of a fun insight, really, that I allow myself and almost want myself to be distracted at certain times, but don't at other times. So for me, it's more of just a deeper exploration of, we live in a society where there is this, at a time in the history of the planet, really, where there are so many interpenetrating energies all the time. And they're coming from so many sources, and they're real in the environment around us in our physical space as well. The people that we interact with, we go into a cafe and we're in a sea of them, and they're not all happy vibes, right? Some people are nervous and they're frustrated and they're anxious and they're fearful. We're walking through all this all the time. Doesn't mean we're going to die. It means it's real energy. And so we need to be conscious that this is happening in our life. And so my point being is that it's so easy to get distracted and being pulled away from our center into this distraction, that annoyance, that frustration, this latest thing out of Washington, this, I cannot believe this is really happening. Whoa, you know, constantly being pulled away from our center. While some of that is natural and normal, of course, and we need to understand how we're feeling about these things that are happening around us, at the same time, we run the risk of continuously kind of leaking energy that's going here and going there and going here and going there and going here. You know, so many people now can't sleep well on a regular basis. And it's not because they're working so hard physically. It's because mentally there's so much they're going through. Emotionally, there's so much they're going through. And they might be tired enough to fall asleep, but can't stay asleep. You wake up 2 a.m, hit the mind going crazy with whatever the issue of the job is or the relationship may be. So we're living in a time where there's a lot of things to pull us out away from our center, and many habits that sometimes that become addictions, maybe as an attempt to deal with the angst from the distractions.
Right.
So we start doing something addictive thing like I find myself sometimes I'll feel kind of a little overwhelmed by certain things going on or the kind of the perfect storm of things that might be happening on a given day or whatever. And I'll go look at my sports app because I'm this like major Golden State Warriors fan and I want to read something that is like awesome, you know, that's just positive, like, ah, good. There's something good happening in the world right now that's not in my control. You know, so it's fun to get onto that because instead of dealing with the deeper issue of releasing or identifying whatever the anxiety I might have, instead I'm sort of going off to a bit of an addiction of,
yeah.
There's nothing wrong with checking sports. I'm not making that a bad thing at all. And I'm glad I have things like that that are outlets. But
sure.
I just use examples like that as a chance to take a look at, well, where am I at right now?
Yeah, well, nothing is inherently bad unless you're addicted to it, right? I mean, it's good to be into sports and play sports and everything else. All right, so what are you up to now, Bruce, and where does everybody find you? What are you working on?
I threw out this term earlier called Renaissance Human, and I've been playing with this and writing a book about it and building a business around it, and it's really designed to help people explore and embrace the fullness of their creation's energy inside them. I believe we are all sparks of creation. We are created by something, whatever our belief system may be. There's the power of creation inside us, hence our ability to create another life. And that spirit of creation plays out as creative expression. And it can be artistic, it can be hobbies, it can be things that we love to do and are just our heart and soul just so engaged when we're doing those things. And to me, for us as a human race, as a planet, to ever come together, it's clearly not going to happen through politics, through religion, through national identities, through ideologies. All of those things are what separate us. But where we are the same is in loving a sunrise, is in being touched by the tenderness of a child, in the magnificence of a piece of music that just sets our heart on fire or creates a sense of awe inside of us. So there are experiences in life that relate to the shared experience of beauty, where I believe we as humanity can unite. We as individuals can unite. We can love a song together. We may have totally opposite political views, but there's something that we have in common that creates a bond between us. So that's what I'm interested in helping people uncover, is those parts of them that are the Renaissance inside of them that may play out as things they haven't done since they were a kid or new talents they've always wanted to take a drawing class or always wanted to be a public speaker, like you mentioned earlier. So having the Renaissance inside of us as a chance to live fully and express the fullness of who we are, the good, the bad, the ugly, the amazing, the magnificent, all the aspects of what it is to be human in this life. And that's what I'm interested in doing. And it's still, we don't even have a website yet. Probably by the time this airs, our website won't even be up yet. But brucecryer.com is my own personal site. I'm still very connected with HeartMath. I've got another project that we don't have time to talk about in depth right now, but called the Whole Life Network, which is a new platform to enable people who are the creators of great ideas or to help humanity or around health or transformation or about aging or well-being or whatever, gives them a new platform for getting their message out while also being able to monetize their work in new and creative and productive ways that serve them and serve the planet and humanity as a whole. So got a number of really exciting, fulfilling projects going and look forward to keeping you informed about everything I'm up to.
Love it. I love that you chose fulfilling and mixed that in there. It's so key to living a happy life, a genuinely, sincerely happy life. So bravo. What's one final thing you can leave everybody with? Whatever's top of mind to help the Dragon Tribe succeed or be more fulfilled in their lives.
I had the good fortune 2 weeks ago to be in Yosemite National Park, not on vacation, but teaching. And I was working with a group of Park Service managers, emerging leaders within the Park Service. And they asked me the same question at the end of a 2-day session with them, kind of like, what's the most important thing in my life right now? What would I recommend for people to do? And I said, one of the key aspects of my life is every morning and evening too, and often throughout the day, I focus on the concept of being, or not just the concept, but being in a state of loving presence. and to try to live from loving presence as much as I can. So when I identify something in me that I'm upset with or feel like, wow, I'm still doing that, have loving presence in my heart. When I'm in a situation where someone else is really struggling and I'm trying to help, but I'm not quite sure what to do, at least I can have loving presence for them. That field of the heart, that I can do, that I can emanate, that I can radiate. And so this concept or this state of loving presence to me is really profound. It's what coherence is designed to be, is for us to have loving presence. And that's what creates coherence inside our body. And so I use that as kind of an anchor for me throughout my day of, okay, this isn't making sense right now. This situation is not feeling good. What can I do right in this moment? I can find that state of loving presence and see where that leads me and see how that can maybe affect a situation in a positive way. So for me, loving presence is something I'm working with a lot and finding it deeper and deeper levels of as I go through a day.
Well, it's brilliantly said, Bruce, to leave everybody with that awareness. And now I understand so intimately and from my heart why I feel so good around you. So thanks for that.
Thanks, brother.
Okay, man. Thank you so much, Bruce. This was mind and heart and just opening on so many levels. So thanks again, brother. Really appreciate you joining us.
Totally my pleasure. Love to do it anytime, man.
I want to thank our guest for sharing his heart and brilliance with us. Thank you, Bruce Cryer. We're all so grateful for your contribution to the world. You can find out more about Bruce at brucecryer.com. That's C-R-Y-E-R. As we dive deeper into facing your dragon, I want to offer the opportunity for you to discover the number one hidden fear stopping you from earning what you're worth. Be sure to take the 1-minute quiz at couragequiz.com. If there's something here I mentioned that you want to review again, keep in mind we keep all the notes for you, including links to everything we've talked about today. You can find the show notes for this episode at faceyourdragon.com/episode009. And finally, I would like to invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review for the Face Your Dragon podcast by visiting faceyourdragon.com/subscribe. Be sure to share this episode with your tribe on social media if it was useful for you. We'd love that. And join our conversation in the Face Your Dragon Facebook group as we talk more about your greatest fears being the very thing that will set you free. Tune in to episode 10 because I'll be talking with my dear friend Freeman Michaels. He was a major soap opera star turned real estate developer turned transformational leader, having interviewed all the biggest icons in the spiritual and self-development space. I truly love and appreciate him for the many layers he brings to the table. We discuss how being an actor in 100 episodes on The Young and Restless can bring you to your calling and deepest work in the world, creating radical honesty and finding true contribution in corporate training, and how it can create big shifts in society and big income. This incredible being and many more on the Face Your Dragon podcast. See you on the next show. And remember, when you face your dragon and take the leap, you will break free.